the more internal contact we have inwardly, the more open we are to the environment. They're synonymous. If we live within our chest, for example, the periphery, between the internal space of our chest and the world outside of us dissolves in our experientially. And yet we can still feel that we're in our chest. We still have the distinction. Fundamental consciousness doesn't erase distinctions, it reveals them. So it becomes very clear what's the internal space, what's outside of us. And yet there's no barrier, there's no defense there. So that contact with the outside world is based on inner contact with ourselves.
Welcome to episode 40 of the Mind That Ego podcast. I'm Ricky DeRiz, and today I'm joined by Judith Blackstone. Judith has 35 years experience as a psychotherapist and teacher of the realization process for realizing fundamental consciousness, as well as the application of non-dual realization for psychological, relational, and physical healing. She currently has 7 books in publication, including her latest, The Fullness of the Ground, A Guide to Embodied Spiritual Awakening. In our conversation, Judith explains the importance of inhabiting the body and developing a strong connection to the core, to integrate the fullness of the self, cultivate wholeness, and connect deeply to life. We discuss the value of modalities such as talking therapy, somatic work, and meditation, the risks of catharsis, maintaining boundaries as consciousness expands, as well as subtle distinctions between non-dual awareness and energetic dimensions. So a warm welcome to the Mind That Ego podcast. I'm really happy to have you here. Could we begin with your definition of embodied non-duality, and we'll take it from there?
Okay, embodied non-duality in the realization process, in the work that I teach, is the uncovering in ourselves a very subtle, undivided dimension of consciousness. I call it fundamental consciousness, but in fact, it's been mentioned in the spiritual literature and has many names, goes by many names. When we uncover it, we experience it pervading our whole body. And that means that we feel that it provides for us an undivided internal wholeness, our whole internal being at once. And at the same time, as we experience it pervading our whole body, we experience it pervading our whole environment. And that means that it gives us a sense of actual oneness, of being made of the same stuff as everything and everyone around us. So internal wholeness, self-other oneness, is the embodied non-duality.
What for you would be the distinction between embodied non-duality and other approaches to non-duality? I know that you talked to, is it the Rang Tong and the Shen Tong approaches? Could you explain that distinction?
Yeah, there are two main schools of non-duality, and there have been for centuries. And the Tibetan Buddhists very kindly categorized those two as Rang Tong and Shen Tong. Rang Tong meaning empty of itself, that there's just nothing there, that is, that we don't exist, that we look for the self and there's nothing to be found, just this changing flux of experience. Whereas the Shen Tong, which is empty of other, means that you uncover everything but the one who is doing the searching, right? Mm-hmm. And that one who is doing the searching is experienced as this ground of consciousness. And these two schools have been described and experienced and presented really throughout the history. And we can find it in Hinduism and Buddhism. And if we look very closely, all around the world.
So this, thanks for that explanation as well. Like, my interest around this is, and also why I'm drawn to your work and your approach, is the issue with non-existence, or this, I would call it a rhetoric, really, rather than an experience. The rhetoric of, I mean, Buddhists would be annoyed with me for saying this, but the rhetoric of no self, as you say, the the approach of uncovering anything but the actual experience of a self. How would you define that in terms of non-existence and the risks of that, or the potential benefits? What would your view be on that?
You know, I think it is a rhetoric. I mean, how can we possibly experience that we don't exist?
Yeah.
So it is an idea, and I think it remains an abstraction, and is sometimes even taught as an understanding. It has some benefits, of course, and that's why so many people have been drawn to it.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, it's in some sense easier to understand than to do the work of uncovering, which does take a little bit of work. Does take a little bit of subtle focus, subtle concentration in order to get to the depth of ourselves and the subtlety of ourselves where we experience that ground of being. So it takes a little work. But to just go around and go, oh yes, there's nothing here, you know, it's that can feel a bit easier and has always been a more popular approach. But it also has the true benefit of helping people let go of their grasp on themselves. Mm-hmm. Right. So if I don't exist, there's nothing to hold on to. Right? So I can let go. There's one popular teacher now who's teaching that this is all a dream. Well, if it's all a dream, if somebody leaves me, if somebody dies, if I injure myself, it's all a dream. Nothing mm-hmm. can really touch me. And to some extent, in terms of countering our tendency to grip on and hold on and not let life change, that's a positive thing. It's also what we in the psychotherapy field would call dissociation.
Yeah.
It's a lack of contact.
Yeah.
lack of contact with ourselves and with the world around us. So the detriment of it, and I've seen this so often as a teacher and as a therapist, is that people will try not to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And the actuality is that since childhood, for various reasons and various ways, we've already tried not to exist. Right? We've been told, don't be so smart. A lot of us have been told that, mm-hmm. right? A lot of us, the kind of smarties, have been told, oh, don't be so smart. And lo and behold, we can actually get ourselves not to be so smart by contracting, by lowering, by even fading out contracting our vision a little bit, not to really, really see what's going on around us. We can be told, don't cry, don't cry. Well, how do we stop ourselves from crying? There's only one way to stop ourselves from crying, and that's to constrict the anatomy involved in our crying. So we've already cut down to some extent, and I can pretty much say that's true of everyone. We've, to some extent, cut down on our full existence, on our existence. So when we're told by a great teacher sitting on a throne or whatever that we don't exist, we're like, oh, I can do that. Okay. I'm not feeling anything. That's a relief. I don't have to understand anything. There's nothing there to understand. So then we see people who've really blanked out their eyes, have even further suppressed themselves in various ways.
I resonate with that. The absurdity, really, like, just from my perspective, the absurdity of non-existence and that risk, like you mentioned, of further suppression. My background experience in depression and mental illness and a lot of dissociation and derealization, so feeling spaced out, that feels like a dream. But
yes.
not in a, it's weird because it's not the opposite of for me, like an awakening experience, but it is, like you say, it's constricted, it's shut down. There's also, you mentioned vision, there is tunnel vision with depression, with anxiety, like a panic attack is your vision is very narrow. So I appreciate you talking to that that fallacy almost.
That's another thing is that, a lot of mental illness is actually a severe fragmentation of ourselves. And when we uncover this level of fundamental consciousness, we experience it as whole, as undivided, and we actually experience it that way. So we can begin to experience our whole being at once. And that really brings in a measure of sanity, right? Of deep contact and of really experiencing our ability to think and feel and sense all at the same time, instead of that fragmentation where we're not able to digest the sensory experience, so we become overwhelmed, we begin to imagine. So we live in the reality rather than in the imagination, in that inflated imagination. So it can go a long way to helping bring people back to a kind of sober reality. For myself, I always felt very kind of flattened to the world, like things were just impinging right on me. And so the sense that there's internal depth and that I actually take up space, that we each take up space, and have our own potency in the world, was a great relief and went a long way to helping me feel normal, to helping me feel like, oh yes, I belong on Earth, just like everybody else. So it's very healing, very maturing psychologically, at the same time as it opens us to what we can call a spiritual illumination.
With the psychology, I'd be interested in your perspective. Like I know in the past I've had I had the assumption that awakening, or to take that further, enlightenment is a complete transformation of emotion, psychology, trauma. It's almost as if all of that stuff is no longer relevant. I'd be interested to hear your view, especially with the background that you have as a therapist,
Yes, I think we
in
have
how
to
that
take care
changes.
with that. Yeah, because one thing I think it's always relevant. I think our history, how we got here, it's always relevant, and it's always to some extent still influencing us. So we need to know that about ourselves, right? We need to know that, oh, I can feel like I'm made of light pervading everywhere, and at the same time, if something happens that's reminiscent of a childhood trauma, there may still be a bit of a reaction to that. And I need to know that about myself and have compassion for that. So I do think that we can't just put aside, oh, now I know the reality of myself and I can put aside all that trauma. That trauma is our it's our good fertile soil for how we've grown, and we need to recognize, I think, and even to honor it.
So I'm interested as well of the relationship between trauma, constriction in the body, and how, for example, to take one lineage of like Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, the idea that stilling the mind in that process releases samskaras, there's a potential release in the body, and then through that a connection, like you mentioned, the fundamental consciousness. So two questions from that. How does trauma suppress that process of awakening, and how would you relate that to the idea in trauma therapy of titration? So not going too much into unpleasant sensation. How would you balance that with this embodied awakening and kind of entering that space?
That's a big question. The first thing I wanted to say was just a little bit more on the last question, and that is that we don't realize fundamental consciousness all at once. It is a gradual process. So we need to know that even though, and it's a big difference, when we now experience oneness and we experience internal wholeness, there's still parts of ourselves that have not yet been released, that have not yet even been resolved. So it is a very, even after we've made that shift into oneness, it's still a gradual process. And enlightenment, we use that word, is still a relative term. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting thing. It's not like all at once. Even any little bit of release is a fantastic feeling. And, you know, to get more of our love, more of our intelligence, it's a wonderful feeling. And yet there's always, you know, we're still on the path. There's always more to go. Now I'm forgetting the whole lengthy question. I remember about titration. I think we've gone a little bit overboard with the titration. It is important that we inhabit the body, and I think that's left out of a lot of trauma work. So in the realization process, we start with inhabiting the body. We start with cultivating that internal contact so that when we come into painful memories, or when we suddenly have when we release a bit of our fascia and can contact ourselves more deeply, it adds to that wholeness. We're not releasing into thin air. We're not just left dangling there with that terrible memory. Mm-hmm. Right? We resolve it, and, you know, by talking about it until it loses some of its charge. And then we inhabit that part of our being, part of our body and being, that was involved in that trauma, that mm-hmm. had been constricted. So, but I think that there has come to be just a little bit of fear about being triggered, you know, about our nervous system becoming agitated. Once we have some contact with ourselves, there's quite a lot that we can tolerate, that we can experience, mm-hmm. that we can allow emotion to move through us, that we don't need to be afraid of our own fear, our own anger, our own grief. So, of course, to some extent, you know, we have to modify that with to some extent. We still want to be careful. But in my experience working with people and working with myself as well, we don't release more than we can actually handle. You know, something does take mm-hmm. care of that. It is a process of understanding ourselves at the same time as we release. So it's a gradual process of accumulating contact with ourselves and knowledge of ourselves at the same time. So it doesn't usually become overwhelming. Now, if you're working with someone, or if you are someone who's had a history of being diagnosed with mental illness so that the center hasn't held,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
then, of course, it's very important to spend even more time cultivating that center. And we cultivate not just the contact with the body, but also connection to the subtle core that runs through the torso, neck, and head. That's called mm-hmm. Sushumna in the Hindu yoga system, called the central channel in Buddhism. So all of that gives us contact with ourselves and perspective to help us tolerate, so that the center does hold even when we come into those traumatic experiences. So that's the balance that we're going towards. Does that answer the whole question, or was there more of that, Ricky?
It's beautifully put, and I'll be conscious of not asking multiple questions at once to be compassionate. what strikes me relating that is my own experience is that meditation and the process of cultivating, I know you wrote a paper, I was reading it earlier today, on meditation as a pathway towards like cohesion and wholeness. And how within myself I've experienced a shift between the sense of spaciousness and my emotions, or the experience of emotions, which, let's just say, on a good day, that spaciousness is so vast in comparison that powerful emotions almost move through that.
Yes.
That I would imagine, I would assume, because these non-dual realizations, even the terminology around what meditation can lead to is maybe lacking from some approaches to trauma therapy. So that's not necessarily a perspective of, you mentioned inhabiting the body or that spaciousness, that it's maybe assumed that that's not the case, where titration is more relevant, possibly.
Not sure I'm following the question, but things that occurred to me as you're speaking is meditation is a umbrella term for so many different techniques.
Mm-hmm.
They don't all lead to cohesion, right?
Yeah.
And people have actually had very bad experiences in meditation retreats and so forth, where they've meditated up and up and up and dissociated, especially if they have a tendency going in,
yes,
towards dissociation. I also worked with someone who was in a meditation retreat and just being in, even in his body and meditating, it reminded him of being sent to his room, of being exiled from the family when he misbehaved. And that was just his personal history. Actually being sent to your room is a rather mild punishment, as mm-hmm. punishments go. But for him, it was very traumatic. So sitting there and meditating actually turned out to be quite traumatic for him. So meditation has both good and bad aspects to it. I actually use the word meditation in that particular paper because I was speaking to the psychotherapy field that would understand that mm-hmm. word. But meditation in itself is a very vague term. Fundamental consciousness, if the meditation knows about fundamental consciousness going towards that, fundamental consciousness is unbreakable, right? So that, because it's just space, I mean, it's palpable space, but mm-hmm. it is space. So when we uncover it, we actually get to an aspect of ourselves that's never been injured and that can't be injured. And so we can let really intense emotion move through that.
Mm.
If we can, and this takes some practice, we can't yeah. just do it like that. But if we have cultivated that unbreakable, pervasive, undivided space of fundamental consciousness, then we find that we actually can release terrible emotions and allow them to move through, not hold on to them, not divorce ourselves from them, but allow them to move through and out, right? And of course, as soon as they leave our body, those emotions, they disperse in the air, right? So that in itself is a means of helping people tolerate the release work involved in trauma recovery.
Yeah. Thanks for that. Also for clarifying how the term meditation is used so widely. I know for me, background initially of pretty basic like mindfulness, meditation, and then evolve into like my meditation now, I will sit and just bring awareness to my body or try and inhabit my body. And that's from, I think, just a long time. I've been meditating over 10 years. So it just allowed me to connect to that spaciousness that you mentioned.
Yeah.
And then having gone through also my own process of getting really caught up with this idea of transcendence
yeah.
and almost developing a negative relationship with my body as not spiritual, and then returning to, wait a minute, why is it that when I feel most present, I'm also most present to my body? Why yeah. do I feel most in my body when paradoxically I'm most connected to my environment? And these realizations that really help to to establish that.
Yes, that's such an important thing, that the more internal contact we have inwardly, the more open we are to the environment. They're synonymous. If we live within our chest, for example, the periphery, between the internal space of our chest and the world outside of us dissolves in our experientially. And yet we can still feel that we're in our chest. We still have the distinction. Fundamental consciousness doesn't erase distinctions. It reveals them. So it becomes very clear what's the internal space, what's outside of us. And yet there's no barrier, there's no defense there. So that contact with the outside world is based on contact, inner contact with ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's wonderful to bring into relationships, of course, you know, with people that, especially with people that we love, right? That's the more internal contact we have with ourselves. Here's something that people listening can try out if you're lucky to have a person sitting next to you. If you hold on to that person's hand and inhabit your own hand, right? Not even project anything out into your partner's hand, but just inhabit your own hand, you'll find that the contact between your hand and the other person's hand deepens. So that internal contact with ourselves is exactly the basis of contact with the other.
Yeah, I really like that approach. And it experientially, it's not a paradox. Obviously, it's a natural process. But when you try and conceptualize, it does seem paradoxical. And I wonder if this was really important and it stood out in your work as well. How do you differentiate between getting lost in the world out there, getting lost in someone else, maybe through codependency, a lack of boundaries, or like a weak sense of self, to use that term loosely, and also with the world? Because I know for me, I've had to do a lot of work because I'm very permeable, which I think on some level has helped me in terms of my spiritual practice, having access to certain states. But on another level, when it comes to relational boundaries and also just overwhelm from feeling overstimulated, how would you define that distinction between what you're talking to and then the kind of maladaptive?
Yes, I think it's really important, because people who are sensitive, who grow up sensitive, can be very open, very permeable. And yet until we reach that unbreakable ground, which is actually a palpable, visually accessible ground that we can experience pervading our body and the other person, then we can be open, but without actually in contact with ourselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we uncover fundamental consciousness, we actually experience it pervading our own body at the same time as we experience it pervading the other body. These are our true boundaries. Our true boundaries is that we're connected to ourself. And that means that we can feel our emotions, we can feel our responses, we know exactly how we're responding to the mm-hmm. other person. We're not coming out of ourselves energetically. This level of ourselves, by the way, is more subtle
yeah.
than our energetic dimension. On the energy dimension, we can mush together with people, and this is something I know very well from my own experience. But on that level of fundamental consciousness, we're not mushed together. We're one but separate.
Mm-hmm.
The realization process has a bunch of practices for people to do together to really experience this, that there's a depth of contact without either coming out of ourselves towards the other person or blocking ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
The two main relational styles when we've had trouble growing up relating is either to block out, protect ourselves,
yeah,
block out the other person, or come out of ourselves, hoping if we just reach far enough, we'll get that love that we crave. But as this pervasive oneness space, we're both separate and one at the same time.
Yeah. That's so beautifully put. Thank you. And this, I really want to expand upon what you've explained there with the distinction also between non-duality or fundamental consciousness and the energetic dimension. This for me is one of the most crucial realizations or experiential discernments on maybe not necessarily more advanced stages of, say, meditation or mindfulness, but the way that you describe, because this is something I'm familiar with, and it's like feeling the movement of energy in my body, in a way that feels distinct from emotion, but probably encompasses emotion, but almost like, it, as you described it, coming out of the body. Like I used to feel a lot either hiding and being defensive or like in conversation with someone. And I actually see a fair amount of contemporary non-dual teachers, a lot of them younger, it seems to be, that are talking to that more maladaptive sense of merging and enmeshment in relationships. And I've just seen this as a bit of a trend and saying like, there are no other selves. It's just another version of myself. When I talk to someone, I completely disappear. And it seems like that is talking more to that maladaptive enmeshment. And it's something I really relate to, as almost like you have to open up to that energetic dimension, because our Western worldview minimizes that and says it's not there. But there is that distinction, right, between the fundamental consciousness, which is still and full as well and palpable, but doesn't move. Whereas the energetic is moving, it sways. And I don't know if that brings up anything for you to riff.
Yeah, I think it's extremely important. And it's an interesting thing too, that maybe, I don't know, 80 years ago, or, you know, the last wave of teaching was to help people uncover that energetic level. In fact, the whole, you know, message of the 20th century was probably energy, you know, in so many different ways.
Yeah.
And of course, if someone experiences themselves as just simply as physical matter, a little bit of breath, you know, and completely separate from the world around them, then to let go and experience that merging, vibrating life inside of themselves is a revelation. And mm-hmm. It's an extremely important transition. However, at this point, so many of us have grown up as that wavy, merging, go to a party, come back, not know who you are, you know, having merged with everybody there. That the next step is really important, that they go one level more subtle mm-hmm. in themselves and find the stillness and the ground of their own individual being, right? That individuality, right?
Yeah.
And that even fundamental consciousness pervading our own body also reveals our individual personality and all of our background, that helps us have something to say when we meet another person. You know, you're mm-hmm. like this, I'm like this. I grew up here, you grew up there. We have something to exchange, rather than, oh, we're just the same person and now what?
Mm.
So there is that deepened contact as oneness, but then there's also, and interestingly, when we know ourselves as that stillness of fundamental consciousness, our energy moves more freely. So we can, without merging, feel an exchange of energies, a freer and deeper exchange of energies, even than we felt when we were just simply the energetic mushed together level. So we can be in our own body and have an actual exchange, a verbal exchange, energetic exchange, exchange of feeling and contact. But we do need to get to that more subtle attunement to ourselves, which again does take a tiny bit of practice. It's not, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of teaching now that you can just sort of let go into it. But that's again going to be an energetic movement, and most people will let go from the surface of themselves and just simply expand out into space. And we've seen plenty of that. And this is not that at all. It's an inward focusing, inward, 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 until we get to that very, very fine attunement to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that can take a little bit of practice, for some people, not much practice, and for some people, a lot of practice, until we actually get to the point where that stillness appears, right? We don't need to let go into it. And if we do let go into it, we let go throughout our whole internal being. It's just there. So it does require some practice. We can't just simply surrender. Well, that's my own true nature. Mm-hmm. That again is an abstraction. That's an understanding. Well, I know that I'm this pervasive space, so there it is, there I am. But no, you're not. You haven't reached that very subtle core of yourself, that subtle attunement to yourself.
I really like this line of inquiry, because it's one that I've explored within myself a lot, and I found a lot of potential traps, you know, along the way. Because it's almost like if you open it, like you say, opening up that energetic dimension can be liberating, but it can almost then become a space where if that's mistaken as the stillness, well, then there's no need, I'll use the term, to step back from, but to put that another way, I've realized that in that space, when I'm noticing the energy of my environment, when that energy is overwhelming, that can be, again, its own tunnel vision, or its own, I'll indulge you if you don't mind with a story of my process with like paranoia through my awakening, spiritual emergency. Because, and I'd be interested to hear your perspective on this experience. I opened up this expanse and could feel my awareness expand significantly, probably more aligned to what you say when you lose contact with the body through that process. But at the same time, just like huge expanse, looking at the sky, looking at trees and being like, that's me. And just this like, oh my God, this is incredible. My previous sense of self just, it's out there, it's huge, great. Except for me, that had a significant shadow in that the way to describe it felt like in that energetic realm, being submerged by water, and then the pressure around, I'll call it my ego, but whatever seemingly separate energetic self was feeling that, and it was manifesting as paranoia, because in my environment, I'd be aware of all this energy that I had identified with as part of me, but I'd still be like in the middle of that and would feel like the center of attention. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense as what you experienced, sure.
Yeah, and it, the reason I use that as an example, because I realized that energetic dimension, whilst holding on to my kind of separate, or a sense of a separate self, led to paranoia. And yet the more I practice being in my environment connected to stillness, it's almost like then that energy started to move through me. And it wasn't kind of contracting around me. It was moving through. So there was like the stillness within that sea of sea of energy. I don't know if this is making, hopefully it's making some sense of the difference in experience.
We definitely need to cultivate that internal contact with ourselves. I mean, it's wonderful to have that initial opening, you know, and to, you know, to be given that, you know, darshan, you know, you know, there it is. And that's where we're going. But then to do the careful work, as you've done, of making contact with yourself, of being able to tolerate that openness. I mean, one thing that happens when we let go to that extent is unresolved nightmares come to the surface and can, you know, and can terrorize us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas if we're in contact with ourselves and we're in the core of ourselves, we have some perspective on that, and we can process that, we can go, oh yeah, that's what happened to me when I'm four. It's not that some ogre is after me. It was an actual ogre, and there he is. You know, and he's no longer in my life, but I'm angry at him. I'm grief-stricken by my separation from him. I'm afraid of him, right? And all of that becomes resolved rather than just simply rising up in our psyche. So that's why it's very important to cultivate the contact, the living in the body, the knowing yourself in the core, before you can really have that doorway into the pervasive stillness.
Yeah. Because it's like, yeah, I like that you mentioned as well. And I think this is a risk of intense meditation retreats, psychedelic experiences. It's almost like they open Pandora's box, where all this material from the unconscious is suddenly flooded into the conscious mind, which is like, it is, as you know, it is an opportunity then to integrate and to see it from a different perspective. But we just do not have that infrastructure, supportive context, really, especially in mainstream approaches, to say, this is what's going on. You've had a huge expanse in your awareness, and because that's happened so quickly, it's just surfaced all this like trauma, which you're now projecting into your environment. And that experience, like, now what?
Yeah, that's exactly what we do. We take those memories and we project them as if they're happening now, and they're not. So that's why the very careful going back through the memories, uncovering them one at a time, really feeling what, really knowing what occurred, what really occurred, even if it means momentarily blaming those people that we maybe basically love, just to know what really happened. And then we can't imagine something is happening now. I think it's quite important. That's why, when very sensitive people tell me they're, going to go on some sort of psychedelic retreat, I'm like, well, you might not need it. You might not need that sledgehammer, to open. Some people do, but some people don't. Mm. Sometimes it's too strong a medicine.
Yes. Yeah. I agree with that. Like, I've had conversations with friends, obviously naming no names for obvious reasons, but friends who are able to, like, I've experimented with drugs in my past, and I think that also contributed to this awakening that I wasn't necessarily ready for. And I've got friends that can go out in a social situation, festival, for example, and take psychedelics, stay out all weekend and be fine. Like, they keep their shit together. And I'm like, I remember having a conversation with one of my mates. I was like, I do not understand how. Because for me, like, even going to the supermarket sometimes, I'm like, okay, this is too much. So I do think people have different, like we talk about the, it's almost like a membrane in some sense, like an energetic membrane.
Yeah.
That if you are susceptible, you can have these awakening experiences, but like you say, you might not need to then really poke that if you're already open. Yeah.
Yes. It's important to know if you're a very sensitive person. And of course, it's also important to know if you have quite a severe trauma history.
Mm-hmm.
So those two things mean to take some care with the opening process. But many of the people who come to this work are very sensitive. And, it's like, remember EST and how I never did EST. You may be too young to remember EST. You don't remember EST?
Oh,
yeah. No, not that.
Well, is this a drug?
That ages me. But anyway, it was a kind of technique that, where you're locked in a room, you can't even go to the bathroom, and the guy is up there saying, you're an asshole, you believe this or that. It's just like hitting at them. And some people emerge from that, finally cracked open. And some people were quite traumatized by it because they don't need that, what we need is just that very gentle inward attunement to ourselves,
Yeah. Like the that just makes me think of this sometimes catch all ethos of certain spiritual teachers that just say, I'm just going to destroy your ego.
Right.
No, you're going to spiritually abuse people and then kind of make an excuse. So it seems like, like that crazy wisdom is such a fine line, and probably best to assume that it's actually someone's, the teacher's distortion. Just to assume that, it's probably safer to assume it's a distortion rather than this person knows you better than you know yourself. They know how to, almost like in that, I don't want to go too far down that path, but it's almost like certain people have tendencies where they it's almost like they actually want to break down people's defenses so they're more vulnerable, so they can control them, even if that's unconscious, compared to genuinely wanting to awaken someone.
Yes, sure. People have
unresolved
power issues, for sure. Yeah. We've seen quite a lot of that.
Yeah.
And unresolved sexual issues.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Fight. As soon as those, like, money, power, sex come into any teaching dynamic, it's dodgy territory. For like the what we were talking about previously, I'd be interested to hear your view on the dynamic between, because clearly you see the value of talking therapy and like going into history and narrativizing experience.
I do, yes.
How do you see the dynamic between that type of narrativization and talking therapy, somatic work, like working with trauma in the body, and then the fundamental consciousness, like a tune into that as maybe a meditation or like an experience? I'm sure there are other modalities I could add to that, but
I think that they're all vitally important parts of our opening and healing and maturing. Right, that that in order to open to fundamental consciousness, we need to release. We need to keep on releasing, because it's a might be a lifelong process. We keep releasing the constrictions, the trauma-based constrictions. And here I'm using the word trauma quite loosely, of anything that was too painful for us to fully experience, especially as children or adolescents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that we had to protect our being against. We had to shut down parts of our being. So the somatic work of, and I think somatic work has to go hand in hand with the cognitive work, with the narrative work, right? Because otherwise we're just opening, we've seen energetic psychotherapy techniques, especially in the past, they're not so popular anymore, where you would just hit pillows and say the worst things that came to you, and you'd bend way over, you know, just release, just release, just release.
Mm-hmm.
And people would go out completely vulnerable into the world, open, but not at all in touch with themselves. Mm-hmm. So I think the cognition, also Rolfing, you know, all the very, very strong bodywork techniques that came up, maybe, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, that would just simply open people without putting them in touch with the roots of those constrictions. For one thing, we'll reestablish the constrictions quite often if we don't know the cause of them. But we'll also just still be vulnerable to all of the things that remind us of our painful past. And we may also just simply be open and permeable without being in touch with ourselves. So the narrative is quite important, the talk therapy, the somatic work is quite important. And then the being in touch with ourselves to the point that we come into that ground of being, that unbreakable, unfragmented ground of being pervading everywhere, also vitally important. So I wouldn't leave any of those parts out.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point that you make on like catharsis, because
catharsis, yes.
That's a nuance that I, within myself, when feeling big emotions, so recently, I'd say over the last year to 18 months, as part of my process, I've been trying to integrate intensity.
Mm-hmm.
How that intensity, as that is felt, intensity as I interpret how that will be judged, but mostly intensity in terms of just my energetic core, and feeling like this is too much, and feeling like it takes up too much space. Like I have moments, like I feel crazy going through this process, but moments on like public transport where I'm sat there and I'm like, I feel all this energy, and I'm looking around, I'm like, it's so weird that we're all just sat here, like, like I want to just jump, like, hey everyone, how you doing? Like, and I can feel
we're
like,
alive.
Yeah, we're alive. I just lose my shit. And like, I think part of that, because it is aliveness, it's just the feeling of being alive, but we live in a very suppressed society. So it feels like it's like a ball in a china shop feeling for me. But the reason I bring that up, I know when I feel strong emotions, we talk about the field that we experience. If I, for example, feel a lot of sadness or a lot of anger, I can feel, and this is something I've been working on as well, feeling like my emotions like overspill, and that it's going to disrupt. Like if I'm angry, it's disrupting my environment because it's almost too much for me to hold. So then I assume it's too much for anyone that I'm in contact with. Keeping it that one line of thinking would be just release all of that energy, catharsis, punch things, throw things, whatever. Do you have other approaches to when big emotions come up and they feel like that there's a lot to hold?
I mean, I think intensity, it's important to feel intensity because then we can feel intensity of love. We can feel intensity of happiness. Of course, if you're very angry at the person you live with, that might be too much for them.
Yeah.
And then it's good to, you know, punch something, you know, in your own space and then go out and use your words, you know, to express what you're angry about. If in fact it's current day anger. I think it's very important to actually feel the intensity of your emotions. Now, it's not gonna disrupt the town you live in. And those emotions do dissipate. I mean, I've worked with people who are afraid of feeling anger at their parents who died 20 years ago because it might actually affect them. But no, it won't. It won't affect them. Those emotions dissipate in the air, right? They're not gonna like travel to halfway around the world and hit your mother, you know, in the belly. They're not. So that's usually based on a memory of having been treated as if our emotions were too much.
Mm-hmm.
As very often our children's emotions are too much for young parents, you know, what can I do with this screaming baby? You know, stop screaming. And the child gets the message that their emotions are too much.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not true. Our emotions aren't too much. They're just what they are. And unless we try to soup them up, and of course there was a whole school of psychotherapy that tried to do that, went for catharsis.
Yeah.
But if those emotions are the genuine response to something that's happening now or that's happened in the past, they need to be felt and expressed.
Yeah. And from that, and just to kind of build on that, like the difference I've noticed over the years is that if I am, to use this language, like connected to fundamental consciousness, I can feel the movement of emotion. I'll turn this into a question because this intrigues me, because I feel that the subjective experience of consciousness and emotionality suggests that emotions aren't just sensations in the body. And I appreciate that all of it is, at least in my understanding, an aspect of consciousness. So the body itself is consciousness in a certain form. So are emotions, so are thoughts, etc. But what's your view on kind of the energetics of emotion and whether they transcend, like where the experiential boundaries of emotions are compared to the body? Because I feel like often my emotions go beyond my body rather than just sensations of energy within the boundaries of my body. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the energy of emotion does extend beyond our body. We can, if we're working with someone who's, or sitting with someone who's crying, we can feel that sadness come towards us. And sure, that does. I think it is important to distinguish between physical sensation, which is touch, and emotion. I think they're two different realms,
yes.
And they have been conflated incorrectly, I believe. And so the feeling of our emotional field is different than the field of physical sensation. And so we can't say that emotions are just sensations in the body. No, they're emotions. They originate in the body, but sure, the energy of emotion will extend beyond it.
Yeah. There are so many directions that I want to go, that I want to follow. I'm aware we're approaching the hour, so I'll ask maybe one or two more questions if that's okay.
Yeah,
I want to check
yeah.
that, because I really like what we've explored, particularly like the boundaries and this notion of when you're attuned to fundamental consciousness, almost as if boundaries are then natural. Like it's actually unnatural to not have boundaries. So you have fundamental consciousness and a natural sense of boundaries of the self.
Yeah, I think our body contains us.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we have an energetic field that extends beyond the body.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we also have the, you know, the skin covering us, and the feeling of what's me and what's not me.
Yeah.
Is a really, really important for sanity, isn't it? You know, right? This is me. The desk is not me. Right? I can feel oneness with the desk because the fundamental consciousness, I experience it pervading the desk. I don't think the desk is experiencing that, but I experience that oneness with everything around me. But I know I'm not the desk, right? I'm not the glass. I'm not you, right? So that's the real distinction. Where do I feel myself? And where do I feel the world around me? I can feel even the air right around my body is not me.
Yeah, something in, because I think this is a really interesting line of inquiry around like me and not me, and how certain approaches combine, like I think Alan Watts actually describes it very eloquently when he describes the self, and like experientially I relate to the sense of myself being my environment and extension of like what is my actual true self. Is it also the tree? Is it also the sky? And feeling that recognition, communication. But the distinction between like what you're pointing to, embodied non-duality, is the awareness that even though there's a connection and an inherent singular consciousness, there's still the dimension of like multiplicity. And even
I'm
though
pretty
I can,
sure if the tree could speak, it would say, no, I'm myself.
I'm you know, so I've got my own identity, been working on it for years. Yeah, and that I think is a lot of modern teachings, and not even modern, like I to be honest, a lot of Ramana Maharshi's teachings I think are a bit misguided, which is probably blasphemy for a lot of people into non-duality, but he says stuff like there are no other selves. And I think a lot of the time his speaking to like ultimate truths, people then take it as a relative truth.
I don't even see a difference between the relative and the ultimate there. I mean, you know, it depends what he means by the word self.
Exactly.
If he means pure consciousness, which is sometimes called self with a capital S, then on that level, yes, there's just that oneness,
yeah.
Right? Even the inanimate objects are part of that oneness, part of that self. But that's different than the I am. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. If the ego becomes entangled in that, the small self becomes entangled, that's when you then start thinking it becomes more like solipsism, where like you as an individual are the center of the universe and everyone else is just a fragment of your imagination.
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
Which isn't,
And that's, you know, That's a pretty crazy making idea. So it,
Yeah.
and it's not true, you know, and we wouldn't be able to communicate if we were the same person. And even my communication with the trees, you know, are dependent on them being treenesses, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I also like the, I know, I'm aware that you don't go into metaphysics so much and like focus on experience, but I do like the philosophical approaches of like objective reality and some like idealism and some schools that think or that claim like when I'm not there, the world doesn't exist. Compared to like, I think we can agree there's a shared reality that even if it is a dream in the sense of a projection of cosmic consciousness, if I close my eyes, you'll still exist. I think I can just make that assumption. And same for you.
Hopefully.
I won't close my eyes just in case.
Thank you.
It's all right, I'll not blink now.
I'm having too good a time. Thank
yeah.
you.
It's like, oh no, what have I done with Judith? Ruin everything. She's gone. Yeah. Sorry, I'm just now going through like non-dual bingo of some of the things that that I find like worrying, because I think where it directs people.
Well, that's the only problem is what they do to themselves.
Yeah.
In order to align with these philosophies. You know?
Yes.
I mean that's the only difficulty. I mean, all of the different philosophies are fascinating. The way people have come to explain the fact that there is this underlying oneness. You know, I mean, I love to study the different philosophies, but when people start to obliterate themselves by shutting down their aliveness, then something is wrong with the way they're taking their philosophy, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I want to make sure I've not like forgot like the most important question or something like that. So okay. I'm just checking my notes. But I think we've covered like the main areas and in such depth and such nuance. So I really appreciate that. I guess to bring us to a close, like people listening, I'm wondering like how do I identify what is my true self, my essence? Do you have any cues where you point people towards to
those
identify?
Those are all
that?
Ideas, all abstractions, you know, and you can choose your ideas. You know, you can choose to believe anything that appeals to you. But in the actual realization work, we're going towards experience, right? And it boggles the mind. Right. But we can know ourselves as that undivided expanse, and that's for sure, you know, that's for sure. What it is has been debated for so many thousands of years that I'm not sure I could come up with the right notion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the ideas are just there to be enjoyed. But the actual work is to uncover that ground of ourselves.
Yeah. Would you like appreciating not wanting to conceptualize experientially what, and we've got to now use language to describe experience, which is always a poor translation, but experientially, what would practices or indicators of inhabiting the body and connecting to that? Are there any that stand out for you?
Not sure what you're asking. How do we know when we're in the body?
Yeah, like for example, like say in internal family systems, their model of the self has like different qualities of like peace, joy and that kind of thing.
I see.
Yeah, if there are any like kind of qualities or
again, you know, those are just words and you know, I just wrote the whole book on that, of course, The Fullness of the Ground. We can uncover qualities within the body, and there is a natural happiness, a good feeling deep within the body. But that's not really the real guide. The real guide can't really be put into words. I use the word contact for it. Mm-hmm. We feel in contact with ourselves. We experience our whole being at once. We experience depth of both our internal contact and our contact with the world. And we do experience that stillness, that transparency, kind of luminous transparency, as the ground of our own being and the ground of everything that we're perceiving around us.
Mm-hmm. Judith, thank you so much for this conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
I really
you.
Enjoyed talking to you.
It's been a pleasure.
Maybe we could talk again at some point if I've not put you off too much. I'll just make sure I don't close my eyes in between now and then.
Okay.
But really appreciate the work that you're doing and for taking the time today to join me.
Thanks so much, Ricky.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Mind That Ego podcast. To stay up to date, you can join the Mind That Ego mailing list if you head to mindthatego.com/MFM. You'll also get a copy of my book, Mindsets for Mindfulness, when you join. You can also follow Mind That Ego on Facebook and YouTube, where the podcasts are also displayed in video format, along with other inspired videos that I create. Or if Instagram is more your social media of choice, you can follow me at Ricky_DeRizz. That's DERISZ.